G'day and welcome everyone to On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. I'll find the most interesting people within our industry to talk all about seaplanes. To get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. Make sure to tell a friend about the show, share it on social media, and review it on Apple Podcasts. It's super easy and it inspires me to keep up the hard work for you all. This is bonus episode number 2, while I'm away enjoying some time away from the mic. But I'll be back next week, returning on the 19th of August on my regular twice a week schedule, bringing you more and more amazing seaplane content. Now today's episode is a must listen. I've been working on this one for a while now. I'm calling it The Seaplane Scares. This is a collection of past guests who have shared a quick story regarding a scare they have had in a seaplane, passing on a valuable lesson to us all. But now, folks, it's time to turn the key. Hearing the engine roar and taxiing away from the dock, we'll avoid the jet skis and sailing boats to get our seaplane sliding on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay folks, I thought I might start off with one of my own seaplane scares. Some of you may have heard this story before. In fact, I actually wrote about it in the Seaplane Pilots Association of Australia newsletter earlier this year. So I thought I would read that to you all now. It was titled, Up Shit Creek with a Paddle. The winter westerlies had set in. The fresh cold air meant jackets and pants were a must. Winter's bone chill produced minimal flying for our company, as the Geelong waterfront was the last place tourists wanted to spend their time. I picked up Dad's car from his house, which was full of the company's signs, flags and equipment, and drove it down to the pontoon to set up shop. Although the waterfront was near empty, I was a young, enthusiastic pilot hoping to snag someone interested in a flight on a seaplane. The straight float Cessna 206 was kept at an old shipyard along the Geelong waterfront, only a minute's drive from the pontoon. The yard included a shed, winch and a slipway that allowed us to access the water. The waterfront ran east to west, with the water to the north and Geelong CBD to the south. Directly east of our yard and in between the float plane's overnight home and the working pontoon was Cunningham Pier, an old port for Geelong's wool exports. By train, they would make the journey to the end of the pier to unload their product onto the waiting ships. The pier was now mainly a car park, littered with fishermen along its edges, leading up to an all-you-can-eat restaurant at the end. The plane sat on the cradle facing west, parallel to the coast. I pulled up the slack on the winch line to kick out the chocks. I then disengaged the gear, released the brake, and set the 20,000-hour stalwart off into the water. Due to the westerly winds, I looped a rope around the front float cleat to stop the station air being blown out of the cradle and into the open water without me. After locking the shed and closing the yard gate, it was time for me to fire up the aircraft's shivering Continental for the journey around the pier to our dock. As an inexperienced pilot, I had about 400 hours at the time, I was lacking a thorough routine in pre-flight organisation. Gripping the wing strut, I pushed the plane out of the cradle and into the open. As I opened the creaky door and mounted my steed, I gave her an injection of fuel from the electric primer. I grabbed down to the magneto switch to crank her over. No key. Oops, I thought. The dash. That's where I normally kept it. A quick glance and feel up top provided no answer. My heart sunk and a rush of guilt and adrenaline started pumping through my veins. I had forgot the key. Ah, the spare key in the glove box. Dad was clever enough to keep a spare key hidden away. As the winter breeze blew me further away from the cradle, I leant over the co-pilot seat to retrieve the flight manual which contained my backup saviour. Where's the spare key? My mind flicked through last week's memories frantically for an answer. Suddenly a light bulb lit up. Dad had used it just days before, but mustn't have put it back. Shit. Okay, it's time to think. How can I stop this seaplane drifting without an engine? I jumped to action and retrieved the anchor from underneath the seat, behind the pilot. the Danforth was hurled into the water with desperation, hoping for the catch of the day, the ocean floor. As the rope slipped through my hands to its end, I tightened my grip, expecting to feel the weight of my drifting career come to a stop, ending this nightmare. But it didn't. I could feel through the rope the anchor dragging itself along the floor of the bay, doing nothing but digging up the soft, muddy, weedy bottom. With no way to stop, I was now on a dramatically slow collision course with a pier full of wooden beams, steel struts, and beady-eyed onlookers. I realised I needed help. A quick call to Dad will solve the problem. You did what? I was due for a beating, that's for sure. Bring the key and hurry up, I returned. I lifted the float locker lid, grabbed out the oar and started paddling for my livelihood. The paddle, feeling more like a stick, did nothing but slow down the inevitable as the westerlies blew harder and harder. Meanwhile, back at Senior Bolton Residences, Dad had rounded up his partner Wendy and grabbed the keys for the plane, which were located strategically on the kitchen bench for his son to grab on the way to work. Like the slow motion of a man running away from an explosion, they scrambled into the car to attempt a world speed record for the drive from Newtown to the Geelong waterfront. No red light spared a chance against the ex-policeman's heavy right foot. Within minutes, the car had arrived at a screeching halt at the waterfront. My arms were tiring, but with the approaching pier only metres away, I powered on. The arrival of the precious key was announced to the world by Dad's tonsils. I looked across to see Wendy entering the water. On the drive-in, they decided that Wendy would swim across, as she was a much better swimmer. However, with Geelong's winter waters a mere 14 degrees, her breath was lost straight away. Freestroke was no longer an option. Backstroke it was. The finish line was in sight, and with that came my sprint. I paddled like a member of the awesome foursome to slow the plane's drift down further. The pier was now overshadowing me, and I could see the frustrations on the fishermen's faces as I started to approach their territory. Wendy was almost at the plane, and I timed the stop of my paddling to perfection. I turned and met her at the stern of the float. "Have you got the key?" I asked. "What do you think I'm here for?" It was a stupid question in hindsight. I rushed to the cockpit, stuck the key in and took a deep breath. She was a tough girl to start on a good day, let alone on a cold winter's morning. This prime had to be perfect. I slowed down my actions to make sure they were thorough enough and correct. I turned the key and, boof, 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 she was alive. A sigh of relief as the impending doom was now over. Wendy climbed aboard shivering as I taxied the unaware seaplane around the pier to our dock. There, standing on the pontoon, was one angry father/boss, and I contemplated turning back and taking off. I focused on the dock, timing my shutdown and heavy kick of right rudder perfectly. Wendy jumped out and was met by a cuddle of towels. This seaplane scare taught me some valuable lessons. The first was about having a proper pre-flight routine, especially taking the time to ensure everything is done properly before jumping in to doing something important. As a new pilot, I could have even made up my own pre-flight or pre-start checklist, and I would strongly recommend this to new pilots in the industry until they get well into their routine. The second lesson was about ensuring the aircraft was secured until a start was achieved. Seaplanes don't have brakes, so pushing them off into the open water, drifting freely and only relying on a successful start to stop you drifting into a pier or drifting towards a waterfall, for example, doesn't seem like the smartest thing to do. Some ideas to combat this would be starting with the tail of the floats parked on a beach, using a dock hand to hold the aircraft with a rope at the tail of the float, getting a tender vessel to stay near the aircraft if the drift option is the only way possible, having a rope with a loop at the end secured over the back end of a float cleat. The aircraft's drifting direction will hold against that rope, and after a successful start, the forward taxi direction will slacken off the rope, allowing it to slide off the rear of the cleat as you go forward. So folks, that is my seaplane scare. Let's now hear from some other guests in the past all about their own seaplane scares.
Hi there, my name is Dion Mitten. If you want to learn a little bit more about my seaplane flying, I did another podcast with Dan. I think it's episode number 17. And I'd like to share a little bit of an interesting moment that I had. Seaplane scare is what Dan calls it. but a little learning experience from my recent float plane flying. So we all know about flight planning and airmanship and decision-making, aeronautical decision-making, and applying a lot of the things that factor into the safety of an operation. Operating in Alaska has a lot of elements from the terrain and the weather that are very difficult to, of course, manage, but also change dynamically. And so a time in Alaska where I thought back was particularly challenging was this past summer of 2019. Alaska, the southern region of Alaska, was just under a dense cloud of smoke almost for the entire summer because of all the wildfires. So a lot of the operations that we did was conducted in and around smoke and very smoke-filled air throughout the Anchorage and the Matsu Valley area. There's a few times when I as a pilot in our operation, when I say we, canceled, changed, or suspended operations because of the smoke. One of those flights was particularly interesting because it had me exercise all the things that I can think of as a pilot in terms of aerial and aeronautical decision-making on steroids, because the situation with smoke changes so rapidly. Now, there was a weather condition where there was still a lot of ground fog filling the valley with a lot of moisture in the air. And then, of course, with the prevailing smokiness and smoke from the nearby wildfires. What I learned from that is smoke has very different characteristics to moisture and the general formation of precip, whether it's, fog or mist. And while you're flying along, and especially seaplane operations, which you're generally conducting at more lower altitudes, AGL, we might be operating at 1,000, 1,500 AGL. One of these times I flew a route that was in known smoke conditions, but with good visibility, at least 3 miles. But the reality with smoke is, unlike fog or a mist bank, which is pretty well defined, smoke will drift around and move around as the slightest breeze comes up to move it around. So I had just flown this route to a lake, and I was returning to the base, and I was going back for the second run. And the net of the story is I could not complete the second run because I found myself all of a sudden going from a good VFR visibility to almost no visibility just in like 30 seconds. And the reality of that situation is it's not detectable, at least from, whatever AGL you're flying. If you're in an already reduced visibility scenario with smoke, you have to be prepared to execute that 180 instantaneously when you're encountering a change in the visibility. And in my, recollection, I say 30 seconds to a minute is about the time that it can go from good visibility to almost no visibility, and where you're not anticipating it because you don't see the defined edge of smoke. And what I had to draw on in a scenario like that was personal minimums, setting personal minimums and keeping to those, as well as setting a go and a no-go point on my route of flight. Now, I had both those things to draw on, and in this scenario, I had to execute a 180 and get out of there because the visibility was deteriorating so rapidly. And there was no time to try and change altitude or do a 90-degree turn. The only way you can go is back to where you just came from. And so my lesson in that, and the things that I take away and the learning, is keep on doing your pre-flight planning. And as part of the pre-flight planning, if you're knowing that you're going into reduced visibility area, look at the map and on your map, define your go, no-go point. And in this case, it could be something like, if the visibility reduces to less than, let's say, my 3 miles surface visibility, this is the point where I'm going to make the 180, or this is the point where I will not go beyond, and map that out relative to your destination so that you know when you're looking at landmarks as you're navigating VFR, what constitutes your 1 mile, 2 mile, 3 mile visibility ranges, and map that out on a map. And this is, I think, what gave me the sufficient amount of information to make that decision about executing the 180. Even though I thought I might be able to go through it or might be able to get good visibility, it's a black and white scenario, and you have to keep to your predefined plan of go, no go. It's almost like a missed approach point in an approach. And I think what I learned from that is to just stick to my plan, and it worked out well.
G'day, everybody. Lloyd Cofield's my name. You'll be able to hear a little bit more about my story on episode 18 of On the Step with Dan. The one we're going to touch on today is my scare. And this one really wasn't one that I was on board, but one that I was very close to, and it stuck with me through all of my seaplane days. And this was one where we were in the Whitsundays. We were all, you know, a very small group that were operating the Amphibious Beaver at the time. And it was always discussed about, you know, the possibility of wheels down on the water or wheels up on the land. And now wheels up on the land, not a great deal, not something that you really want to be doing without planning, but the chances of doing serious damage are fairly minimal. There's, you know, there's design features that allow it to be done reasonably safely if need be. But the other side of the coin is a whole different story. Wheels down on the water is something that, you know, is often discussed and incredibly easy to do. When you've got an aircraft that doesn't have electronic systems in it, there is some electronic systems that can work for you, but the aircraft that we operated at the time didn't have anything in it. And it is very easy to do, or can be very easy to do, when you're operating in an environment where you're doing multiple sectors, very short sectors. You might only be in the air for 10 minutes and your landings really carry no sequence depending on the operation on the day. Water to land, land to water, land, land, water. You can do all of those in any combination, one after the other. And, you know, on a very busy day, it is easy to get a little bit distracted and get it wrong. So it's something that was very much drilled into us from the early days. But unfortunately, I was got to see the result of one that was handled, you know, handled wrong. And it was on a day off. I was sitting on a yacht at Langford Reef, which is just across from Hayman Island in the Whitsundays. I was very new to the Air Whitsunday operation at the time. And it's, you know, it's busy. There was beavers coming and going. And so we're sitting on the yacht there one day, and I heard the beaver coming and looked over my shoulder and seen it and thought something just caught my eye. It just didn't look quite right. And I had another look and just went, oh, the undercarriage is down. And, you know, the indicating systems sometimes can give false indications. We always operated with mirrors for exactly that reason, so that if you were in any doubt about the indication, you could just look in the mirror and verify. So, you know, my initial reaction was that, hey, this is probably somebody just cycling the gear to try and make sure that the indications are right. But nonetheless, I'll keep an eye on it. And then just after that, you hear the power start to come back, so the aeroplanes commence a descent. So immediately take another look, and the wheels are still down. And at about that point, I started to think, oh, no, I think I know what's going on here. There's no way of getting in contact with the aeroplane direct, but I, working for the operation, I did know that there's a discrete frequency that Hayman Island could use. So I ran to the yacht radio, called them on channel 16 and said, get in touch with that aeroplane immediately. They're about to land with their wheels down. But it was all a little, not quite enough and carried out a little bit too late. So we didn't quite get there. So I ran back up onto the deck of the yacht and just helplessly watched as this aeroplane basically crashed on the water. It was, it didn't crash immediately. It settled into a very normal looking landing, but with heaps and heaps of spray. And then as the nose of the aircraft settled onto the water, and obviously the nose gear then catches the water, the aeroplane just immediately stood up on its nose, tail vertically in the air, sat there for a second or two and sort of made up its mind which way it was going to go. And then it went over on its back. And at that point, it just really scared me, because it just disappeared so quickly that there was just nothing but the underside of the float sticking out of the water. And that just happened so quick. I just thought, oh my God, there's, you know, if anybody's in the back of that, they're not going to be able to get out. That's going to be a real struggle. Very fortunately, there was only the pilot on board. The pilot managed to get out safely. And then, you know, about half an hour later, we ended up with the pilot on the back of the yacht and the upside down and very wet beaver tied to the back of the yacht. But, you know, that has stuck with me a long time, just to, you know, try to never be complacent in doing those sort of checks and make sure that you take the time and don't get distracted. Be aware of when the distraction can happen and try and manage that. So that's my scare and my story. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I was on episode 22 of On the Step, and this is my seaplane scare. We were doing a caravan flight out of Key Largo. At the time, we were flying passengers from Fort Lauderdale Executive out to a resort in Key Largo. We had dropped them off and everything was fine. And I was on my takeoff roll. We were on the step and the cockpit filled with smoke pretty instantaneously as soon as we got on the step. So we shut the plane down and taxied over to the marine utility vehicle, the MUV, which is basically a floating dock, but it's actually classified as a boat, where we, you know, were docking to bring passengers to and tied up, opened the engine up and took a look at it and couldn't really see what was wrong. We had to get our maintenance team out there. But we've spent the whole day gathering supplies to work on the plane, to assist our maintenance team that was out in Fort Lauderdale and had to drive in, and it was an interesting experience because working on the plane over water, we didn't want any fluids or hazmat material to fall into the water. So we had to make sure we had buckets to capture anything that was coming through and a bunch of planks across the floats. And we were walking back and forth and it was a crazy day. Spent the whole day out there working on it with our maintenance guy once he got out there. Ended up being just a loose hose and some oil and nothing too bad. When we took off, everything was fine again and the repair was done. But I think the lesson learned there is just there's never a time when you can relax. You always have to be sort of always ready to act, especially on the water, especially in a seaplane. That was supposed to be just one of the easiest flights possible, you know, just take off leisurely, beautiful day, perfect VFR, barely any wind, everything was gorgeous. But it ended up being, you know, a long maintenance event and we had to think quickly and act on our feet to make sure that the plane was okay and everything was solid and we could work on it. So I think, yeah, lesson learned is just always be aware, always be present in the moment, always be ready to act, always think that something's going to happen and be ready to fix it. And that's my seaplane scare.
Good day. My name is Levi Guimon, and I was on episode 24 of On the Step, and this is my seaplane scare. My wife and I were flying out to a breakfast place on floats. It's a local restaurant, maybe 50 miles from home, with a seaplane dock in the cove and in the downtown part of the lake, and just a couple minute walk over to the cafe. And nice day, you know, no reason for concern of any kind. We had a good breakfast and then headed back home. And I think my wife was actually asleep when this happened. And I was flying along at maybe 1500 feet over a remote lake. No chatter on the radio whatsoever. It was a Sunday morning. You know, blue sky, unlimited visibility. And over the top of my airplane, I caught a 182 or a Cessna 206 at just the last second go across the top of my wing. I estimated it was 75 feet away. I never saw it at all until it was right over the top of me. And I never could reach him on the radio. I was quite wound up at the time. We listened to a frequency that's just a common traffic frequency for the rural part of the state we live in. Never heard him on the radio, never reached him, never heard anything. And that was a very close call and kind of a wake up call. You know, if I would have been a little bit higher, you know, maybe he saw me, maybe he didn't, but we definitely would have collided. And I think he was just hidden by the wing of the Cessna. And like I said, it was that the upper portion of the windscreen is kind of open just a little bit in between the wings. And that's the first time I saw him was when he was right on top of us. The takeaway from this would be just to remain vigilant, always be looking out for an airplane that may or may not be there. I know with ADS-B, it's common to see most of the airplanes show up on a screen inside the cockpit, but there's going to be a lot of people without that still. So you're not going to see every airplane that's out there on a computer screen in front of you. When I fly now, I'm, you know, always scanning for traffic, for anything, you know, that may arise, in addition to looking for any emergency landing spot that might be available in case of a mechanical issue with the airplane. But definitely keep your eyes out for seaplane traffic. I know a lot of them don't turn the radio on, especially in the more rural areas. And that's it. Keep an eye out and stay safe.
G'day, I'm Toby Dawn. I'm the chief pilot of Blue Sky Airways, and I was on number 25 of on the step, and this is my seaplane scare. So I was early in my seaplane days flying the Beaver, and we owed some thank you flights to some people who had done some work for us. So I arrived to do their seaplane flight in the Beaver, and it was quite a windy day. It wasn't outside the limits of the aeroplane, but it looking back, it was outside the limits of my own ability at the time. So I really didn't want to do the flight, and I'd sort of voiced my concerns a few times, but then was looking back, was probably peer pressured into deciding I should do the flight. So I loaded the passengers and went out, did our run-ups with wind spray blowing over the windscreen and that sort of thing. So that should have been an indicator, which looking back, it probably did appear to me as an indicator, but the peer pressure was stronger. So I started my takeoff roll and or takeoff slide. And with about probably just due to the direction of boat traffic, which was another added factor, it was a busy day on the water. Had about a 45 degree crosswind, sort of headwind turning into a crosswind by 45 degrees. And I couldn't get the aircraft up onto the step. It kept smacking into the back of the waves. And then it felt to me as if the aircraft wasn't going to get airborne. So I ended up sucking up my own ego and aborting the takeoff. And taxiing back to shut down, but I had to give myself a bit of a scare just because I realised halfway through the takeoff run that it was the situation was probably outside my ability at the time, and that I really shouldn't have turned up for starters, and then shouldn't have continued to load the passengers and do the flight. But looking back, I think the lesson to be learned is always trust your gut feeling, because usually it's right. And always err on the side of caution rather than on the side of being pressured into do a flight, no matter how much you think you should do it.
Hi, my name's Michael Bostock. I was on episode 4 of On the Step, and this is my seaplane scare. Take you back now to August of 2017, back when I was just a budding little Aussie in Canada, in the far northwest of the Northwest Territories of Canada, at a place called Glacier Lake. It's one of the most spectacular mountain lakes that you've ever seen. At this stage, I was about halfway through my first float season. So I had about 200 hours on floats and just starting to become comfortable with how everything was working with the operation. I had probably about 150 hours on floats in the 206, which is what I was flying this day. Now, for those that haven't flown the 206, this particular one especially was a bit of a notorious beast for being very hard to get onto the step when in hot, high and heavy conditions. And on this day, it was that perfect storm of hot, high and heavy. Had four passengers on board, so I was pretty close to my max weight. To set the scene for the day, like I said, it was middle of the season, so we're middle of summer. You're looking at a temperature of somewhere between probably 30 and 32 degrees Celsius. And we're a little bit later in the day than what I would normally be there due to some fog earlier in the day at our base in Fort Simpson. So it just sort of pushed the whole day back by maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours. I was going on one of our long day tours, scenic day tours, and Glacier Lake was the furthest stop from base. And from there, I was getting ready to take the passengers back towards Fort Simpson. Because of the different time of day and maybe even just the prevailing weather conditions on the day, we had different wind on the lake than what I was used to. It was the first time that I'd come up against the northwesterly wind on this particular lake, and it was a one way in, one way out valley. You couldn't get out the other side. So, but this particular day, I had about anywhere from a 3 to 5 knot wind from the northwest coming out of the mountains. And I knew that with the weather conditions and with the way the aeroplane was loaded, I wasn't going to be able to get onto the step with that tailwind. So I made the decision to taxi downwind along the lake and basically go back far enough so that I would be able to get airborne, conduct a 180-degree turn, and fly to the lake as per normal. Because the temperature was so hot, the cabin was pretty stifling with five people in there, even with both doors ajar a little bit. So passengers were quite keen to get moving and sort of get some nice cool air up at altitude. I got to a point where I was pretty comfortable on the lake, thinking I've got enough room here to get the aeroplane off the water and into the air, and sort of thought, well, maybe I'm pretty inexperienced with floats. Maybe I'll just go back a little bit further. You know, another couple of minutes of taxiing won't hurt. I taxied a little bit further. In reality, probably only went maybe another 100 or 200 meters, but in my mind, I had enough room. So I turned around, got all the doors closed, and unleashed the power of the Continental 550 engine in the 206. And to say that I was initially underwhelmed would be quite an understatement. The aeroplane didn't really perform and sort of start, the nose didn't start to come up for quite a little while. And I was initially, probably in the first 5 seconds of the takeoff, a little bit worried. But then everything started to line up and started to perform how I sort of thought it would. And as such, I was starting to feel more and more confident. We finally hit the magic number that would allow me to get on the step. At that point, I'm thinking, all right, no worries. We'll get off the water here. I'll do a quick turn and off we go. Once off the water, I started trying to climb. Once off the water, I realistically couldn't get the aircraft out of ground effect. I checked my engine gauges, and quite literally saw the oil temperature needle move in front of my eyes from about mid-green towards the red within a couple of seconds. So I knew that the engine was getting pretty hot pretty quickly. I looked up, I saw that those 8,000 to 9,000 foot mountains that I was so conscious of earlier were now a lot closer than I had remembered, and a lot closer than I thought was possible in such a short period of time. At that point, I had a little micro sort of flashback or a voice in my head that was my instructor from when I did my initial float grading and bush training course about a year earlier. So to take you back about a year, I was doing my initial float rating and training in a place called Kelowna in British Columbia, Canada. And one of the first things that I was taught after learning how to get the float plane off the water was a method of climbing out of valleys and canyons where you would zigzag up the valley in order to fly a greater distance, which would mean that you could gain more altitude in said valley. And then as you got towards the end of the valley, if you still needed more room to climb, you do a quick 180 degree turn and repeat the process. And you might end up doing this two or three laps in a valley or a box canyon or whatever it might be. Initially in my training, I found it a little bit full on and confronting. But as I got more and more confident, I started to enjoy it. And this turn, the instructor called the I'm going to die turn. The idea being that, you know, you've either made a mistake, something's gone wrong. Like I said, you've got yourself into a box canyon, maybe you've hit a downdraft or something, and you're about to fly into a wall. So you do this this low-level turn, and the idea is that it's going to save your life. So back to the day in question, I am sitting there trying to climb the aircraft out of ground effect. It is now starting to climb at a very slow pace. I made the decision, all right, now I've got to get over to one side of the valley to try and make a little bit more room so that I can make this turn. And that's the point that I started to descend. I was probably now back down to around the 50 to 100 feet. And I'm like, all right, this is not going to work anymore. I'm looking ahead. I don't have any more lake left. The river that feeds the lake is braided. It's full of silt and sandbars, and I sort of decide, right, it's either put it down into that or start this turn. About 100 feet above the surface of the lake, I said, right, I've got to do this I'm gonna die turn, because that's what was running through my head at the point. And I must say, I managed to do a 60 degree steep level turn at 100 feet above the water, and it was quite possibly the best ever I'm going to die turn I've ever done. I might be a little bit biased because I made it out the other side, but yeah, it was an absolute pearler. Managed to remain over the lake the whole time, which was a good thing because I was still below treetop height, and then proceeded to fly down the lake and on the rest of the tour as the terrain sort of began to fall away from me. The lessons that I learned from this was that the only thing more useless than runway, or in my case, lake behind you, is that fuel that you left in the bowser. If in doubt, go further. So, you know, it comes back to that initial, that first instructor you ever had. They always, you know, might yell at you when you've got 10 or 15 meters of runway behind you. I had well over a mile of lake behind me, but I said, oh, I've got enough room in front of me. Passengers are hot. I don't want to waste time, and decided to make an attempt at a takeoff when really I should have gone back further. The next thing that I learned is always have a plan B, C, D, whatever you need. Like I said, there was some fog that had delayed us early in the morning. As a result, we were there at a different time. You know, I should have had a plan B of going back to the beach, plan C of continuing down to the other end of the lake, plan D coming up with some weird and wonderful method of taking off in the other direction. So yeah, I think just having multiple plans and sitting there with a cool head and assessing each of them is an absolute key. Another thing that I learned was to think outside the box, but always be self-critical of any decision that you're going to make or have made and ask yourself afterwards, could have I done better? In this case, I could have used the wind to get on the step and take and started my takeoff run towards the mountains and then maybe attempted a step turn 180 degrees and taken the departure downwind, which in hindsight would have probably worked quite well. The 206, the big problem was getting the aircraft onto the step. Once on the step, it was fairly straightforward getting it off the water. All this thinking outside the box comes with experience. And, you know, while I had many thousands of hours of wheel plane time, that was just it. I didn't have much float experience, maybe 200 hours at that stage. And as a wheel plane pilot, you get into the mindset of, I point the aircraft in a certain direction and that's my takeoff direction. It does not change by more than maybe 5 or 10 degrees as you try and maintain that center line. So there's key differences between the float and the wheels. And the final one is that passengers, as much as they might complain about how hot it is or how late they are or, you know, how bad the weather is, they want to get to their destination more than you, and they really don't care for dying. You as pilot in command need to make a command decision, and sometimes that is going to mean that you need to make the hard or the unpopular decisions. Remember that there's always plenty of pilots that have been pushed into bad situations by pressure from a passenger, pressure from a boss, pressure from themselves. It's probably more so pilots that have been pressured by themselves into an uncomfortable situation. So those are the lessons that I learned from my experience, and hopefully you can learn a few lessons from listening to this, and you will not find yourself in a similar situation.
My name is Steve McCauley. I'm the executive director of the Seaplane Pilots Association here in the United States. I will be on a future episode of On the Step, and I'd like to share my seaplane scare with you. So we were departing a land runway in Boulder City, Nevada, in our Grumman Albatross. It was one of my very initial flights doing my pilot training at the Grumman Albatross. It's a very complex airplane, very heavy airplane. We only fly it with 3 crew members. So we have a pilot, co-pilot, and a flight engineer who's also a type rated pilot. So we were taken off on a training flight, and immediately upon initiating the retraction of the gear, we indicated a problem. We saw hydraulic pressure altering and noticed that the gear was traveling very slowly. Ultimately, we had blown a primary hydraulic line, hydraulic line. And here we are in upwind in a Grumman Albatross, very complex airplane, very difficult airplane to fly. And we were experiencing a complete hydraulic failure, which was evolving very quickly. This is complicated somewhat. You know, if we could get the gear up, we could go land in the lake. So we felt confident about that. But that makes for a difficult fix. We'd much rather come back and land on the runway if we can for maintenance purposes. And the emergency gear extension procedure in a Grumman Albatross is a pretty invasive procedure. You have a glass window in the cockpit that you can see the nose gear from. You actually break that glass window out, and you have a pole that looks like a broomstick that you actually physically push the landing gear out. And then as you make your way back to the main gear, you actually have a fire axe mounted on the interior of the airplane. That fire axe is there to cut a hole in the main gear well. So you can literally cut a hole in the well structure. And then again, take that pole and push the gear out into their downward lock position, which we didn't want to do. The importance was all of this is going through. We had briefed on the potential for a hydraulic failure, engine failure, the other failure. We are trained to do that beforehand. But the important thing was to keep a solid and steady state of mind and to analyze the emergency and to deal with it. So as we noticed pressure fluctuating and decreasing, we immediately decided, okay, we're going to extend the gear with whatever fluid that we have left and try to get a positive lock, which we were able to achieve. But to give you an idea of the amount of fluid that we dumped overboard, the Grumman Albatross has 25 gallons of primary hydraulic fluid and a 25-gallon reserve. And by the time we got geared down and locked, we were right at the bottom of the second 25 gallons in the reserve. We were able to come back, make a successful landing, and thankfully we were able to replace the hydraulic one and ultimately had a happy ending because we went flying again that day after cleaning what remained of the 50 gallons of hydraulic fluid off of the fuselage, the engine cowling, the tail of the airplane. So the point of all of this is keep a steady state of mind, keep your head in the game, and fall back on your practices and procedures. Deal with the task at hand, slow things down, think about them methodically. In an emergency situation, there's no reason why you can't come home at the end of the day and go flying another day. So that's my seaplane scare, and we look forward to talking to you guys again soon.
And that's the show for today, folks. I hope you liked the seaplane scares idea. I'll be collecting stories from future guests to put together another seaplane scares episode in the future. I've had a great month off from the mic, but as I mentioned, I am back next Wednesday with some more incredible stories from float pilots all around the world. So keep an eye out for those. Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.